WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen in for Terry Gross. In the last 6 months, the brutal regime of Zaire's Mobutu Sese Seko has begun to collapse, hastened by his declining health and by a rebellion led by Laurent Kabila. His rebel forces have captured half of the country. The United States has had a long and supportive relationship with Mobutu, which dates back to the late 50s, just prior to Zaire's independence from Belgium. It was known then as the Belgian Congo. Shortly after it became an independent country in 1960, it erupted into civil war. The Soviet Union and the United States were drawn into the conflict, making the country a stage during the Cold War. Sean Kelly was a journalist in Zaire when Mobutu took over the country in 1965. Kelly is the author of America's Tyrant, The CIA and Mobutu of Zaire. The book is about how the CIA helped Mobutu seize power and control Zaire for more than 30 years. In that time, Mobutu's personal wealth has grown into the billions, while Zaire's economy is in shambles. Kelly covered Mobutu's move from head of the military to leader of the country for The Voice of America. Kelly says Mobutu seemed unsure of himself when he first appeared in public dressed in full military uniform.
He was very stiff, and he went over well because he was a figure of considerable power, and that translates itself generally into approval in that part of the world. And so he was certainly accepted. I'm not sure he was ever very dearly loved by the population.
Well, one thing that he wanted to do and actually did once he assumed power was to create a kind of authentic African identity, obviously to take back an identity which was destroyed by Belgium over the years that the Congo, now called Zaire, was a colony of Belgium. Describe for us what this effort was to give Zaire its own African identity.
Well, it started out almost immediately after the coup. He began renaming the capital, which for years had been named for King Leopold of the Belgians. It was Leopoldville, and he renamed it Kinshasa. Then, after the capital had its name changed, he moved to some of the other cities that had obvious colonial names like Albertville and Stanleyville and Elizabethville and changed them as well. Then he went even further and insisted that anybody who had a so-called Christian name, a name that would have come from the colonial power, change that so that all of a sudden overnight a lot of name changing went on and people sort of invented names for themselves. He changed his own name, of course. So.
And my understanding of his name, it translated into the all-powerful warrior who, because of his endurance and inflexible will to win, will go from conquest to conquest, leaving fire in his wake. Is that a pretty fair translation of what his name meant?
Yes, there are some other versions of that as well, but they all amount to a pretty far cry from Joseph Désiré Mobutu, which was the name he started out with.
Let's backtrack, if we can, and talk about the legacy, I guess, of Belgian rule in what was, again, then called the Congo, now called Zaire. The Congo got its independence from Belgium in 1960, and they were a particularly brutal colonial power. Can you describe how they ruled and controlled the Congo?
Well, it was unfortunate in many respects that the Congo ever became a Belgian colony. Belgium had no tradition of colonialism like the French or the British or the Portuguese in Africa. They were not a maritime nation or a nation with any history of international commerce like the other colonial powers. So when King Leopold moved into the Congo and established himself there, and for many years, of course, the Congo Free State was his personal possession. It started a series of as well a policy, if you will, on ruling governance that pretty much stayed with, characterized Belgian policy even when it ceased being his private property and became officially a Belgian colony. It was ruthless. It was done for high profit. And when independence came, it came without an awful lot of preparation of the people who were to become independent.
Well, I was wondering, when independence came in 1960, was the Congo in any way, shape, or form ready to be a country?
Not really. As a matter of fact, just 5 years previously, the Belgian government had a plan before it which contemplated independence for the Congo in 30 years. That 30 years was telescoped to 5. The actual decision to give independence was done approximately 6 months before the event. It was just decided on very short notice to go ahead and get rid of this colony, in which there was a certain amount of turbulence going on. And also, at that time, if you'll recall, the French were having a bit of a problem with one of their colonies, Algeria. And it was causing a lot of difficulty in France. The Belgians did not want to be presented with a similar situation over their colony. So pretty much the Congo sort of got dumped. 1960 was a year of independence throughout much of Africa, but the most other states were better prepared for it than the Congo.
When did the United States then get involved in the domestic policies of the Congo?
Well, you could say it was that year just before independence. When the country was still a Belgian colony, the American ambassador in Brussels made a trip out to look the colony over, and he brought with him several people who would later be attached to the first American embassy in Leopoldville. And he derived some impressions from that trip, which were subsequently documented in a book called The Congo Cables, Madeleine Kalb's book, which was one of the first books in the United States that really got into some of the skullduggery that took place in the Congo during that period. And Madeleine Kalb, through using the Freedom of Information Office, Freedom of Information Act, was able to get declassified a cable from the American ambassador in Belgium to Washington, urging a policy that would overthrow Lumumba and create a new government. So I think probably right about the time, or shortly before independence, was when that intervention really began. The United States, at least the people who were representing the United States in Brussels, did not take a very good view of Lumumba. There was considerable concern about him.
Well, the thought was, and I guess because he had turned to the Soviet Union in dealing with some of the chaos and rebellion in his country shortly after independence, the thought was that he was a communist. Was he, Lumumba?
I don't think so, and Belgians I've talked to don't either. He was a nationalist. He was a man who, like many of the Congolese leaders, had been very poorly prepared for the job that he faced. He'd not had much of an education, and he was thrust into this position of leadership, trying to hold the country together. Part of it was seceding, the most important part, Katanga, now called Shaba Province. That was where the money was. It looked as though the Belgians were supporting that secession, so he thought the Belgians had sold him down the river. He appealed to the United States for help. We turned that appeal over to the United Nations, and then the United Nations moved very slowly in his view. So he wasn't getting help from anybody. The one part of the world that did offer him, or appeared to offer him some help, was the Soviet Union, and they didn't come through in any big way.
What was the CIA, United States, involvement in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba?
Very difficult to pinpoint, actually. What happened was that Lumumba had been taken prisoner with U.S. help by Mobutu and held in prison in an army camp, and then brought out of the camp on the understanding that he was being asked to come back and participate in the formation of a new government. That was the subterfuge that was left, that was used to get him to accompany several other people on a what turned out to be a plane trip to what is now Lubumbashi, where he was turned over to his enemies and killed probably that day or the next. The role of the CIA, as best as I can determine, was to facilitate first his capture, secondly, that the actual deed was done by people who were very close in terms of their relationship with the CIA. The CIA had actually started out to kill him themselves. This was revealed in a Senate investigation that took place in 1975. Assassins were hired, poisons were sent out, but it became very difficult to carry it off. And the man in charge of the whole thing took the view that it might just be simpler to turn Lumumba over to his enemies.
How did the CIA then come to enlist the help of Mobutu?
That goes even back further than the assassination of Lumumba. What happened was that right after independence, the army revolted against the officer class. And it was one of the first times in history that an entire army went into revolt against their officers. The officers of the Congolese army were all Belgian. And the enlisted men decided that they were not getting a fair shake out of independence and that they didn't understand why they had to have Belgian officers. And so they went into a mutiny that spread itself throughout the Congo. Part of the problem, of course, was that they hadn't been paid. And the United States apparently moved in through the CIA and guaranteed payment to at least those military personnel in the Leopoldville area in Kinshasa to assure that stability would hold in that particular area. Mobutu, having been put in charge of the army at that time, became the logical vehicle for those to handle those payments. And to his credit, it was really one of the ways in which he developed a constituency for himself. When the mutiny broke out, Lumumba appointed Mobutu to go around. Well, first of all, it made him number two in the army. Number one was just a political appointee. Mobutu had experience in the army. He'd spent 6 years as an enlisted man before independence. He was sent out around the Congo to rally the support of the troops that were involved in the mutiny and also to get them to vote their candidates to be made officers, so that the first officers in the Congolese army were those who'd actually been voted into office by the enlisted men. And in the course of this, Mobutu developed a constituency in the army that he developed much further later on. And he has always been a sort of man of the army and had the loyalty rented of soldiers who were the ones put closest to him.
I'm curious how Mobutu was able to take power, take control of his country.
Usually, he did it by getting other people to do his fighting for him. First of all, the United Nations came in and put down the rebellion in Katanga, Shaba, as it's now known. And then, once that was dealt with, the rebellions elsewhere in the country that broke out in 1964 and 1965, Mobutu was able to enlist the support of the United States and Belgium and other allies to come to his aid there. The United States participated in the training and supply of a group of foreign mercenaries who performed much of the fighting in putting down the rebellion in 1964. We even provided some mercenaries of our own to make sure that the job was done right. We had some Cubans who were left over from the Bay of Pigs who'd come back from Cuba, and we brought them in to actually lead the mercenaries into combat because they were a very effective fighting force amongst themselves.
Well, I'm curious whether Mobutu had any real political base within his own country, or whether he really was propped up by foreign countries, foreign governments, including our own.
That was pretty much the case. We propped up the army. He was in charge of the army, and he got propped up with it. But he made sure that those units loyal to him were the ones that got the best training and the best equipment.
Sean Kelly is our guest today on Fresh Air, and his book is called America's Tyrant, the CIA and Mobutu of Zaire. He covered the civil war in Zaire, the Congo, as it was known back in the 1960s. He's covered other civil wars around the world as well as a Voice of America correspondent. He's currently a professor at American University. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Sean Kelly, and we're talking about Zaire and Mobutu. His book is called America's Tyrant, the CIA and Mobutu of Zaire. Zaire is a country enormously rich in things like rubber and coffee and copper and diamonds, very rich in minerals. Was Mobutu, at least in the beginning of his reign in Zaire, able to exploit some of that wealth, not just for himself, but for the people of Zaire? Were there positive changes early on in his government?
Not really. The problem was that he let the infrastructure fall apart in the Congo, now Zaire. The roads were not repaired. The system of river transport was allowed to deteriorate. The airports deteriorated. The Congo had been a very rich country agriculturally, as you point out, rubber, cotton, all of those, coffee, all of those things, plantation-type economy. But all of those products had to be moved to market. And with the infrastructure falling apart, the Congo very quickly turned into just a mineral provider, and that was an area that Mobutu could accomplish what he wanted to do, which was skim off a good portion of the minerals that moved out of the Congo, the minerals being principally diamonds, copper, cobalt, that sort of thing. So it didn't have much of a beneficial result for the people, particularly the farmers, the peasants, because it was all directed at the minerals. And as a consequence, they went very quickly back to a sort of subsistence economy.
How much has the end of the Cold War changed the U.S. relationship with Mobutu and Zaire?
Well, it's changed very dramatically because we no longer have the need for Mobutu that we had periodically over that period of the Cold War. Our last use of him was during the supply of military equipment to Jonas Savimbi in Angola during that civil war, which ended in 1991. So there has not been a dramatic instance where Mobutu has been able to be particularly effective. And since the end of the Angola war was pretty much the end of the Cold War, that is to say, the end of the Cold War brought out the end of the Angolan war, as far as we were concerned, the need for Mobutu has diminished, and as has our relationship with him. We are now, by we, I mean the United States, is now paying a lot more attention to the human rights abuses that have taken place over the years, and all of a sudden we've discovered that Mobutu is a crook, and this comes as a sort of a great surprise to everybody in Washington, although it's been widely known for decades.
Well, just a couple of years ago, there was a bloody civil war in Rwanda, neighboring on Zaire. How much did that civil war, you think, loosen Mobutu's grip on power in his own country?
Well, Mobutu had largely ignored the eastern part of the country, the eastern part of Zaire, for years. He'd, as I said earlier, allowed the infrastructure to rot, the roads to fall apart, and to have any governance that was there was minimal. So when the troubles broke out in Rwanda and Burundi and began spreading over into Zaire and involving a Zairean population of Tutsis who had been resident in Zaire for a long period of time, then he was in a very poor position to bring that under control. And Laurent Kabila, the leader of the rebel forces, has taken advantage of that weakness, and it has accelerated his ability to move into as deeply into Zaire as he's been able to do.
What can you tell us about Laurent Kabila? And he is the rebel leader who's fighting Mobutu and calling for Mobutu to step down from power. What do you know about him?
Well, he's a man who's been around for a long period of time. As a matter of fact, he was there during the 1964 rebellion in the eastern part of Zaire. He did not occupy a position of prominence at the time, but nonetheless, he was a participant in some of the negotiations that took place during that period. He was briefly with Che Guevara, the Cuban leader who fought in the Congo for the better part of a year or so in 1965, and then went pretty much into obscurity during the days when Mobutu was really very much in control, and now has emerged as the leader of the rebel forces and is directly challenging Mobutu and says that unless Mobutu steps down, he will move on Kinshasa militarily.
What, if anything, do you think the United States owes Zaire because of the CIA relationship with Mobutu?
I think we owe quite a bit in terms of a sense of responsibility for what has taken place there. We used the leadership during the Cold War to our advantage, and sure, we put quite a bit of money in. We rented the Congo, as it was, for a period of time, or rented the services of its leadership. But now that it's falling apart, and the people that we dealt with are in the circumstances in which they find themselves, it seems to me that the United States does have a responsibility, and I would hope that we will assume the position of responsibility that is necessary under the circumstances.
Well, Sean Kelly, I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Sean Kelly is a professor at American University and the author of America's Tyrant, the CIA and Mobutu of Zaire. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.